It's Wednesday, October 16, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. On Monday, the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences announced that three Americans would share the 2013 Nobel Prize for Economics. The three Americans are Eugene Fama and Lars Peter Hansen of the University of Chicago and Robert Shiller of Yale University. The three did independent work, but there are issues in terms of the science of finance that binds them together. The 2013 prize was not a surprise to most economists. Mark Gertler, a New York University economist, said, quote, "Nobody's scratching their heads on this one. They've all been on the short list for many years. The interesting thing is how the three are connected," end quote. It's a very interesting story, but perhaps it's not so interesting on its face to many Christians, including many thinking Christians, who underestimate the importance of economics as a discipline, as an intellectual endeavor, and as a science. It's often referred to as the dismal science, dealing with things that many other people don't want to deal with. But economists are among those who are on the front lines of dealing with how people actually behave, trying to understand human economic behavior, and there are few things the Christian worldview would affirm that are more indicative or revealing of who human beings really are and how human beings really act than matters economic. There's more to the story, of course. The three who were chosen do not stand arm to arm on many issues of economic controversy. Eugene Fama, for instance, the recipient of the award this year, whose expertise is finance, in a January 2010 interview in the magazine The New Yorker said, quote, "The rest of the world got converted to the notion that markets are pretty good at allocating resources. The more extreme of the left-leaning economists got blown away by the collapse of the Eastern Bloc. Socialism had its 60 years, and it failed miserably," end quote. One of the issues of pride for many economists is that they actually deal with measurable statistical information. They're actually looking at how human beings organize their economic lives individually and corporately. They're less interested in what people say about their behavior than what their behavior actually reveals. And the Christian worldview would affirm that there are few issues that are more revealing than what we do with money, what we really prize, how we understand the link between labor and investment and income, and how we understand our confidence in the future. Do we intend to get everything out of this life? Are we trying to leave something to our heirs? Do we believe that we're making a meaningful contribution to society by our economic activity? Do we believe that there's accountability there? Those are issues that have deep philosophical and worldview significance. And, of course, that significance is underlined by the basic clash between capitalism and communism, between those who are the proponents of a free market and those who are the proponents of socialism. It really does matter. It matters hugely, urgently, and importantly about how a society is organized. There's something else revealed, as the Wall Street Journal makes clear in these latest awards. Since the year 2000, Americans have won 21 of the 37 physics prizes, 18 of the 33 medicine prizes, 22 of the 33 chemistry prizes, and an astonishing 27 of the 30 Nobel Prizes in economics. That's right. Since 2000, an astonishing 27 of 30 Nobel laureates in economics live in the United States. That leads Brett Stevens, writing in the Global View column of the Wall Street Journal yesterday, to note that one very clear mark of national greatness is the number of Nobel laureates who live within the nation. But that raises a very interesting point. The issue is, where do these laureates live, not where were they born? As Stevens writes, this is a measure of national greatness. How is national greatness best judged? The typical view is that what matters is size of economy, population, landmass, navy, nuclear arsenal, etc. However, he goes on to say, a better metric for greatness is the ability of nations to produce, cultivate, attract, and retain intellectual greatness. What is, he asks, the ratio of Nobel laureates living in any one country to the total population? Here are some fascinating statistics. Russia has a population of 142 million, only three living Nobel laureates, or one for every 47 million citizens. A more interesting case, he says, is Israel. The Jewish state should be a Nobel powerhouse given the fact that Jews, 0.2% of the world's population, have won 20% of all Nobel Prizes. But where do most of the Jewish winners of the Nobel Prize live? Not in Israel, but in the United States of America. The brother of one of this year's Jewish winners of the Nobel Prize in chemistry said, quote, "There are a lot of smart people in Israel, and at the same time, there was not a job, so he left," end quote. What about Europe? Europe has half a billion people, but a relatively minuscule Nobel representation, as Stevens writes. France has just 10 living laureates. Germany does better with nearly 30, though at least 9 of them, including Henry Kissinger, physicist Arno Penzias, and this year's medicine winner Thomas Sudhoff, have long lived in the United States. Britain does about the same as Germany. One of the other things Brent Stevens points to is the fact that even though many Americans seem to panic over the relative academic success of 15-year-olds, and in this case, given studies globally, American 15-year-olds tend to fall behind some, for instance, in Scandinavia and Korea. As it turns out, the Scandinavians and the Koreans don't produce many Nobel laureates. As he writes, Singapore, South Korea, and Finland may regularly produce the highest test scores among 15-year-olds, but something isn't translating. Nobody from Singapore has ever won a Nobel. Korea has won, and it's for peace. The Finns last took a science prize in 1967. But the issue here isn't just national pride. That's not insignificant. But the larger question is this. Why has America become such an engine, such a magnet for Nobel laureates? I think Brett Stevens is onto something when he says that the reason, he says, the secret of America's Nobel sauce, it isn't hard to understand. It's an immigration culture that welcomes people coming to make this kind of contribution and creates for them an hospitable space, a space in American universities, a space in American government, a space in American culture, a context that allows those who bring such intellectual gifts to prosper. As he writes, a mostly private, highly competitive, lavishly endowed university system, juiced by federal funding for fundamental research, a culture of individualism, and an ingrained respect for against-the-grain thinking, end quote. That's a big problem in many other societies where, especially in the sciences, innovation isn't actually rewarded. In that case, you shouldn't be surprised there are few Nobel laureates. He ends his article by saying this, anyone who thinks America's best days are behind us should take a close look at the latest Nobel list. It says something that we take it for granted, end quote. And speaking of the intersection between economics and human behavior, there's nothing that reveals human foolishness so much as the industry of gambling. And that point was made very graphically over the weekend within the pages of the Wall Street Journal. Here's a major article for you, the real odds on gambling. It turns out that we now have data previously inaccessible to us in terms of the odds that actually operate within America's casino system. As Mark Marimot writes, recent revelations by the industry have made very clear that the business of gambling is more dangerous for gamblers in terms of financial losses than even previously understood. How often do gamblers really win, he says? What are the chances that a gambler will win on a single day or over a longer period? Don't bother to ask the casinos. Although they gather vast quantities of data about their customers for marketing purposes, including win and loss tallies for many regulars, casinos keep such information a closely guarded secret. But now, thanks to an unprecedented trove of public data detailing the behavior of thousands of internet gamblers over a two-year period, the Wall Street Journal can provide some answers, he writes, and then he does. On any given day, the chances of emerging a winner aren't too bad. Very interesting point. If you gamble one time and only one time, the odds aren't so horrible. But of course, the gambling industry isn't built on someone gambling one time. As he writes, the gamblers won money on 30% of the days they wagered if they wagered just one day. But continuing to gamble is a bad bet. Just 11% of players ended up in the black over a full period of time, and most of them pocketed less than $150. They're gambling thousands, and the small percentage that didn't lose a great deal gained only about $150. The skew, he writes, was even more pronounced when it came to heavy gamblers. Of the top 10% of bettors, those placing the largest number of total wagers, that's over a two-year period, about 95% ended up losing money, some losing tens of thousands of dollars. Big losers of more than $5,000 among these heavy gamblers outnumbered the big winners, a staggering 128-1. So when you're thinking about the odds of gambling, you have to recognize, as this study makes very clear, it's not just what might happen on any single day, it's what happens when gambling becomes a habit. And the gambling casinos only make money if gambling becomes a habit. Oh, and by the way, the casinos count on some people losing big. According to this Wall Street Journal article, just 2.8% of gamblers produce half of the revenue earned by the casinos. That's right, less than 3% of the total number of gamblers provide the income, half of the income, for the gambling casino as a whole. This is known in the gambling business as revenue concentration, and as one gambling industry observer said here, this is something the gambling industry doesn't want its customers to know. Jim Kilby, a former professor who has written three books on casino management, said that the scant number of winners among gamblers was surprising even to him, and as he noted, quite obviously, it should be an education to gamblers. As Marimot writes, quote, although gamblers know the house has an edge, quote, the average person doesn't understand the math of the multiplier effect. Casino games are nibbling machines, and the more nibbles you have, the bigger your losses, end quote. At the end of his article, Marimot actually quotes one of the people from the gambling industry who says, putting the best face on this data, that gamblers should understand that they should really be gambling for entertainment, not for the hope of any kind of financial gain, because, as he said, based on the evidence, people who are hoping to gamble to get rich shouldn't, quote, because they won't, end quote. Given the track record of this kind of industry, you might wonder how in the world do legislators and governors move to put this kind of thing before their people? What is the motivation? Of course, part of it is the attempt on the part of state governments to try to make up for lost tax revenue, or at least to come up with new ways of getting revenue for the state. But as Thomas Kaplan reported yesterday for the New York Times, there's something more nefarious going on here as well. As he reports, during the final 2 months of this year's legislative session in Albany, New York, more than 36 companies, Indian tribes, and trade groups with an interest in gambling or horse racing lobbied New York State's government. There were more lobbyists representing the gambling industry than there are members of the New York legislature. The industry's backers got what they wanted, and in 3 weeks, the state's voters will go to the polls deciding whether to amend the state constitution to allow up to 7 new casinos. He then writes, "The referendum, backed by Governor Andrew Cuomo and approved twice by the legislature, is the product of years of debate and big spending in Albany. Since 2005, gambling and horse racing interests have spent more than $59 million on lobbying in New York State alone." That, according to an analysis of disclosure filings by Common Cause New York, a government watchdog group. And what did they get for their money? Here again, the New York Times comes through with some very interesting news reports. It turns out that this week in Albany, New York, a state judge is going to have to decide if the language New York's citizens will face in the ballot box on this issue is prejudicial. And on its face, it certainly is. But on this issue, the New York Times deserves credit not only for its news reports, but also for its editorial stance. As the editor said earlier this week, New York voters will decide in November whether to allow 7 new casinos to open across the state. Governor Andrew Cuomo and most members of the legislature are strongly in favor of these casinos, but they do not have the right to skew the language on the ballot, as they have contrived to do in a way that tips the scales in favor of a pro-gambling outcome. The editors go on to write, "Judge Richard Plotkin of the New York State Supreme Court has an opportunity to remedy the situation. The original ballot language recommended by the state attorney general's office was neutral. Quote, the proposed amendment to Section 9 of Article 1 of the Constitution would allow the legislature to authorize and regulate up to 7 casinos in New York State. Shall the amendment be approved?" End quote. But the actual language that the governor and his gambling industry cronies got on the ballot not only asks if the amendment should be approved, but it says that the casinos would be for, quote, legislative purposes of promoting job growth, increasing aid to schools, and permitting local governments to lower property taxes through revenues generated, end quote. Now, in what sense of what government at any time would such language be considered neutral? Of course it isn't. The New York Times editors are exactly right. This is no place for the government to be making an argument like this and indeed making promises about lower taxes if people will simply vote for the amendment. The editors are clearly accurate when they write, this is advocacy pure and simple, and it could well determine the outcome if it sticks. A Siena College poll showed voters were in favor of the amendment when they heard the pro-jobs language, but were split down the middle when they heard the neutral wording, end quote. Again and again, we point out that one of the chief responsibilities of government is to protect people rather than to prey on them. It's bad enough that a government would be so irresponsible as to put this before the people just as some kind of a neutral proposition when it will not have a neutral effect. But to contrive to distort the democratic process with this kind of propaganda masquerading as a constitutional amendment, that's clearly a step too far. If nothing else, these news stories indicate that when the voters face the gambling issue, even before they go into a casino, the odds are already stacked against them. Next, while talking about the New York Times, I want to credit the editors of that newspaper for last Thursday running an opinion piece that ran directly counter to their own editorial stance. In this case, it has to do with laws passed in New Jersey and California that outlaw so-called reparative therapy or conversion therapy, therapeutic approaches that attempt to help people to change from a homosexual to a heterosexual orientation. And what we're talking about here are laws passed in those two states that have made it illegal for mental health professionals to use these approaches with minors, with teenagers and children. Now you have these two men writing this opinion piece, protecting the speech we hate, and they do hate reparative therapy. They write, "Let's get this out of the way right up front. We have no sympathy for the plaintiffs in these cases. We are offended by their speech. We think that the world would be a better place if the plaintiffs accepted gay people for who they are instead of treating them as if they were broken and required what is euphemistically called reparative therapy." In other words, these two writers make their opposition to reparative therapy very clear. Their normalization of homosexuality, they write about up front, but they are opposing those laws. The laws passed already in California and New Jersey and recently upheld by one federal court. Why are they writing this? It is because, they say, if this kind of conversation between a mental health professional and a patient isn't covered by the First Amendment, then almost nothing is. As they write, the central legal question is this: is one-on-one advice and counseling about homosexuality or anything else protected free speech under the First Amendment? As they continue, the answer to that question has national significance and will extend well beyond the fate of the California law and a similar one in New Jersey that is now being challenged in a federal court. The Ninth Circuit's ruling that talk therapy doesn't count as speech has drastic consequences for thousands of Americans who speak on all sorts of harmless everyday topics. These two lawyers with the Institute for Justice point out that the courts in this case, trying to uphold those laws passed in California and New Jersey, are arguing that speech amounts to conduct. These two lawyers come back and say, if that is true, then what professors do in the classroom under the guise of academic freedom is conduct. If that's true, then what many people simply count upon as speech is going to be classified as conduct. These two lawyers predict that the United States Supreme Court will strike down these laws precisely because, if they do not, it will affect so many other areas of human endeavor and professional work. This is one of those opinion pieces that tells us two things. Number one, it isn't just people who agree with you on any given issue who may be intellectual allies when it comes to a legal case like this. Sometimes people on the right and the left, people on various sides of specific issues, they may oppose each other on the issue, but on the rights that are involved, there can be a great deal of consensus. People from the right and the left sometimes show up making the same arguments. That is especially true in religious liberty cases and often in free speech cases as well. But the second point I want to make is that editors of major newspapers like the New York Times really do perform a public service when they run both sides of a story, not only in the news, but in the opinion pages as well. That's something we can hope could spread to not only other newspapers, but to other forms of the media as well. Finally, on the issue of this so-called conversion therapy or reparative therapy, we as Christians have to fight for the right of persons, whether mental health professionals or ministers or others, to speak on the basis of their moral convictions related to someone struggling with any number of issues, homosexuality or homosexual identity included. But the other thing we need to recognize from a Christian perspective, from a Christian worldview perspective, is that therapy simply isn't enough. Our approach can't be merely therapeutic. It has to be deeply theological. But we need to recognize that when it comes to freedom of speech, the speech that is theological can be just as jeopardized as the speech that is labeled as therapeutic. This is an issue that, of course, has immediate relevance, most importantly in New Jersey and California. But when it comes down to the worldview and the religious liberty issues involved, it should be of immediate concern to every thinking Christian and to every American citizen. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.